God-given abilities and weave them together into something that just feels like us. I have always found Joanna's parents to be fascinating. They met in Korea back in the 1960s. That's where her mom was born and where her dad was stationed in the Vietnam War. Jo's mom was a firecracker, and honestly, she's exactly that way today. She's the kind of woman you love and respect for lots of reasons. Her bravery and willingness to leave everything she had ever known for the sole purpose of marrying Jo's dad, Jerry, was admirable to say the least. I can't imagine how scary that must have been, moving to a foreign country and only knowing a handful of words in English. The two of them were real rebels, genuine hippies, which if you know them today is actually comical. But once they grew up and they had their three beautiful daughters, they traded in their free spirits for responsibility, order, and safety. And get this, after owning his own Firestone dealership for 10 years and then selling it, Joe's dad became a safety manager for Bridgestone Firestone Corporation. Imagine that. I married the daughter of a safety manager? My mom grew up in a traditional, hardworking family, and my father was raised by a single mother. He grew up in borderline poverty, his mom working three jobs just to survive. When my mom and dad got married, they made an unwavering commitment to my sister and me that we would always have a loving, safe place to come home to. They were self-made, middle-class Americans who made a conscious decision to be generous with their time and resources, truly always giving of themselves. This mindset was really what molded me into the daring, confident person that I am. They say opposites attract. I don't know what kind of research has been conducted to back up this theory, but if mine and Joe's relationship is any sort of testament, that statement couldn't be more accurate. During our dating years, it was glaringly obvious how different we were from one another. She's a quiet, detailed, cautiously safe door locker, and I'm a wild, obnoxious, break every rule in the book kind of risk taker. Now, I don't break rules just for the heck of it. I even acknowledge sometimes that they exist for a reason. It's only when the rules are dumb and need to be broken to achieve some greater good that I disregard them completely. My trip to Mexico really was this make-or-break situation for our relationship. Joe mentioned shortly after that excursion that the time and effort she had invested in my businesses while I was gone was all the convincing she needed to jump in and help out where she knew how. I'm not sure if she just felt sorry for me and my lack of accounting expertise, or if she was genuinely excited about being part of the team. Nonetheless, she was in, and I couldn't have been more thrilled. I felt like I had found my secret weapon. This girl was sharp and good at everything, and she was hot. Joe had spent the past 10 years working for her dad, doing the books in his back office at the tire shop. That type of stuff really geeked her out. She loved doing the kinds of things I just couldn't stand to do. So this was the beginning of that very best partnership that I could have ever imagined. Joe is calculated. She takes into consideration any and all potential collateral damage. I think she must have some big whiteboard in her brain that's operated by these little gnomes or something. They're in this war room of sorts, tallying up all the pros, all the cons, literally playing out every possible scenario to ensure the best and safest decision is made. I really do appreciate that trait of hers. I just don't understand it. The caution she exercises in the midst of every last decision has saved us enormous amounts of time, money, and pain over the years. But I just can't bring myself to operate like that. When it comes to safety and risk, I'm glad that opposites attract. We learned early on in marriage how to leverage our differences for greater outcomes. I would be out and about purchasing property after property to flip and sell while Joe was quietly running the numbers, her mind four steps ahead of mine. With each potential buy, no matter the risk level or how it could affect our bottom line, Joe always seemed to get behind my half-baked ideas. A few of the times that Joe showed restraint might have cost us something, but mostly her care allowed me to do my thing freely. At the end of the day, we're both stronger for it. Joe has learned when to raise that little white flag and when to let things play out. And this give and take sort of mindset really works for us. She allows me to risk and fly, but when she sees a nosedive in our immediate future, she calls for an emergency landing. And I've learned to trust those little brain gnomes of hers. I know she only calls Mayday when things are really looking dicey, so at that point, I'd better listen. Joe and I were easily able to identify our strengths and our weaknesses early on. Joe's safe, detail-oriented design eye and my risky, big-picture, get-it-done attitude were the perfect storm for opposites attracting. We are crystal clear on these differences in our strengths, so we know how to run fast in our own lanes and steer clear of each other's. It's really refreshing to feel covered in my weak spots, especially by my wife, of all people, who I trust more than anyone in the world. That's what I'd call hitting the jackpot, to say the least. That's not to say we don't exercise our weaker muscles from time to time, because we do. I push Joe towards getting comfortable with big picture thinking, encouraging her to gain some confidence in her instincts and her dreams. And she keeps me focused on small things, because the little details are really what keep us on track. But we both walk in authority in the areas of our natural God-given strengths, and that seems to be what really makes working together seamless in our case. As we've learned to harness these opposing characteristics and shore up each other's weaknesses, we've managed to make working together look pretty easy. I get that a lot of couples couldn't work together. This is not for everyone. People just figure they'd wring each other's necks or something. And if we were to choose to zero in on all of our differences, Joe and I could easily drive each other crazy too. But when you recognize what lane you should be operating in and stay there, the implicated dangers of working together start to fall away. It's when you merge lanes and start telling each other what each should do that this whole lifestyle we've chosen can really start getting complicated. It's just human nature for couples to turn their insecurities and their animosities against each other during life's most challenging seasons. But Joe and I were constantly working on encouraging each other in our harder times because we realized the only way we were going to make it out alive was together. Both of our parents worked together at various seasons of their lives, and I think that contributes to how natural it feels for us. Joe's mom worked diligently for years to keep costs low at her dad's Firestone dealership, and my mom worked alongside my dad at both their sporting goods stores and their flooring company. Having that modeled for us by our parents and seeing how they worked through their various differences gave us that much more confidence that this lifestyle could work for us too. Juggling being co-workers along with being a married couple can really feel like walking a tightrope at times. The hardest part for us is turning off the work side of things and focusing on us. We have to be really intentional to not talk about business all the time. For example, we have to choose not to discuss project lists, payroll, or an upcoming client on date nights. When we get home at the end of the day, the business truly needs to be out of sight and out of mind. Our babies and our marriage must be the only things in the world that matter at that moment. This has proven to be our biggest challenge, and it definitely sounds easier than it is. Work-life balance is difficult in general, and we are far from perfect. But we will never stop striving for a healthy relationship in all of its various forms. We had to get a few good fights under our belt before Joe and I figured out our big secret to working together successfully. The key for us has always been to give each other enough slack in the rope for us to make mistakes. Affording each other a little extra rope has mostly equaled smooth sailing for us. So we try to give each other plenty of space. We don't like to corner each other or demand that we talk our problems out right at the heat of the moment. Giving each other a little room to stretch and to spread our wings also makes our marriage feel a little spacious. There's room to try things out or even change direction. The parameters aren't so tight that we feel suffocated by our relationship, and there's room for both of us to continue to grow and to thrive and to do our work to the best of our abilities. The irony here is that while we give each other a lot of emotional and mental space and lots of room relationally to try new things and to even make mistakes, we have much less physical space in our own relationship than most. Joe and I wake up together. We go to work together. We spend all day side by side, and then we go to sleep right next to each other. That's a lot of togetherness. I wonder if one directly has something to do with the other. Maybe it's when you're always feeling restricted by your spouse, ordered or micromanaged, that those boundary lines of the relationship just feel too confining. It could be because Joanne and I give each other the room to be ourselves, encouraging each other on the run and grow beyond our perceived limitations every day. and we love spending time, nearly every waking moment together. Who wouldn't want to spend all their time with someone who loves them for who they are and believes the very best about them, who encourages them to fight for their dreams and is the very first one to jump in and fight by their side when needed? And then at the end of the day, there are safe places to land. Whoa, writing this out makes me really want to spend even more time with Joe. I have to admit it took us a while to figure all this out. When we did our first flip house together, I was doing the painting, sanding the floors, staining the wood, and so forth, and Joe was picking out finishes and paint colors and doing the other design things that we needed. It was her first time to do anything like this and my first time to ever do a flip house with a partner. She wanted to micromanage basically every detail. She questioned why things weren't getting done yet and gave lots of tips on how to do things more efficiently. But I wasn't about to take that advice from a first-timer on how to do something I'd been doing for years. We had our first big fight during that job, and I'm pretty sure it took us 10 steps backwards in our relationship. After that little spat, Joe and I realized that we could either pull against each other and create this volatile environment where it would be even hard to survive, or we could pull in the same direction. And we've learned that when we pull together, we are a tough team to beat. When Joe and I get into an argument, this tug-of-war concept has really served as a compass of sorts, helping us navigate our way out of differences. Our pulling-together mentality helps us keep fighting for the same thing. Of course, working with the spouse isn't right for everyone. I completely get that. It's a constant fight, fighting for each other, fighting against each other. It seems like it never ends. And on top of that, work can start to become your marriage's centerpiece if you allow it. But these same principles don't just apply to working together full-time. They apply when you're working together on repainting your house, picking out a new car, or even going grocery shopping. Whether you work together or not, there are going to be opposite forces pushing against you and pushing against your marriage. That's a fact. But it's in these sink or swim situations that you have the opportunity to be a safe place for your husband or your wife rather than making the struggle even harder. You can fight for each other and with each other instead of always against each other. And when the two of you come face to face with resistance, you can pull so hard on the same end of that rope that opposition loses its grip and falls face first in the mud. Life can be tough, and the world can be cruel and relentless. So far as I can see it, the point of marriage is to have a partner, a friend for the long journey ahead. I think by and large, people underestimate their spouses. Joe and I have always believed that it is us against the world. It's not that we think everyone is out to get us, but we know that in the world, there is this one singular human who will be on our team every single time. Understanding this and protecting it at all cost has become the bedrock for our marriage. It starts with being willing to be seen and known and loved for who you really are, as you are. Then you have to be willing to turn around and do the same thing, loving your spouse in their totality, flaws, blemishes, and quirks included. It's from there that you can begin to forge a trust where creativity and compassion can really grow. Taking on the world as a unified, fortified duo is not just a romantic notion. It's a powder keg. Together, you can set this world on fire. Chapter 5. Wrecked. It's possible you've been admiring the scar on my forehead since the very first time you ever laid eyes on me. It's an awesome scar. I got it right after my first son, Drake, was born. Joe tends to remember the details a little better than I do, and she claims Drakey was only a few weeks old when this happened. I was thinking he was a little bit older than that, but I suppose it doesn't matter now. What does matter is that the incident that led to the scar was another wake-up call for me. I'd managed to get myself a brand new four-wheeler. And let me tell you, for a kid who grew up in Texas, that four-wheeler might as well have been a Ferrari. It was sweet. It was a big investment, too, especially considering Joe and I were living in an 800-square-foot house, and we both had a brand new baby to feed. But we'd made a little extra cash that month, and I just figured it was time to go out and live the dream. So I bought that four-wheeler without giving it a second thought. Next thing you know, me and my buddy John took it out and started taking turns on it, really just messing around, off-roading while our wives hung out and watched. But here's the thing. If Beavis and Butthead and Dumb and Dumber had a baby, John and I, we'd have been their love child. Or maybe it's love children. For some reason, we've just always pushed each other to do stupid things whenever we're together. Joe had Drake out there in his little car seat, and maybe I was also trying to show off a bit for her and the new baby. Anyway, John and I started doing tricks, driving up the berms and taking these really cool jumps. To be honest, I don't even remember what happened next. But at one point, I gunned it up that embankment. Maybe I was crazy enough to think I was capable of jumping off the far side and flying through the air like some guy sponsored by Red Bull at the X Games or something. But I think I was just planning on hitting the top and to spin off to one side, kind of like the skateboarders do maybe at the top of a steep ramp right before coming back down. Only something went very wrong. I gunned it and launched that four-wheeler straight off the other side of that hill, off a sheer cliff that dropped a good 20 feet to the ground. All I remember thinking was, good feeling gone. I tend to embellish a bit, but my honest guess, if I'm 6 foot tall, that thing had to be 20 feet. No matter how tall that cliff was, when you land flat on your face, that's a big fall. Like I said, I don't remember exactly what happened next, but the way I remember it is that my body came off the seat while I held onto the handlebars. The speed forced my feet out from underneath me, which means I was flying kind of like Superman through the air. I was horizontal to the ground as the four-wheeler slipped out of my hands and shot ahead of me. I grabbed the back of the seat just trying to hang on. Now, if I'd managed to pull myself back onto that seat and then landed that jump, it would have been legendary. I would have looked like one of those professional motocross drivers, flying through the air on a death-defying leap and then landing with grace while the whole stadium full of people simultaneously chanted, "Chip, chip, 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 chip." Only that's not what happened at all. In a matter of 2 seconds, the four-wheeler and I went our separate ways. I face-planted into the dirt from nearly 20 feet up. This wasn't like tripping and falling while on the playground. Joe and I both think I must have blacked out in that final moment because I don't even remember throwing my arms up to protect my face. And listen, I love my face. It all happened so fast that my reflexes didn't even have a chance to kick in. How the impact didn't break my neck or kill me, I'm still not sure. Heck, maybe I should go ahead and brag about that. After all, I am writing a book, and what better place to talk about how awesome you are than in your own book, you know? Just seconds after I hit that dirt, I put my fist into the gravel and I pushed myself into a kneeling position. Meanwhile, Joe with the car seat in her arms and my buddy and his wife came sprinting around that hill to survey the damage. That's when I noticed the blood. In just a matter of seconds, I had managed to create a puddle that I was now kneeling in. I pulled my shirt off and pressed it to my forehead, and as my buddy John came rushing around the corner, "Bleep, Chip, we thought you were dead," John said. Looking back on all this, this whole event slightly reminds me of Tuff Hedeman. My basic synopsis, Richard Neal Tuff Hedeman. For those of you who don't follow bull riding, Richard Neal Tuff Hedeman is a championship professional bull rider who got slammed in one of the most traumatic accidents in the history of the sport. He was riding in this one rodeo, and an infamous bull named Bodacious kicked so strongly and so violently and with such perfect timing that Tuff's face smashed into the hump on that bull's back. The impact broke just about every bone in his face. Then Bodacious kicked Tuff's limp body sky high and sent him slamming into the dirt, just like a rag doll. But somehow, as the whole crowd watched in horror, Hedeman got up. With a little help from the rodeo clowns, he walked himself out of that arena. This despite the fact that he would require several reconstructive surgeries just to put his face back together. I remember the announcers saying, quote, "What would have killed a normal man didn't even knock Tuff Hedeman out," end quote. I bet Tuff and I can both attest that when something like this happens, you walk away a changed man. Okay, so back to the scene of the accident. We turn to John's wife, the only medical professional in the group, to see if she felt like I needed stitches. I pulled the shirt away from my head, and the woman's knees nearly buckled at the sight of my bloody face. She quickly turned away to hide her gag reflex and croaked out, "Yes, you're definitely going to need stitches." At the time, we had no health insurance, so we had to call my brother-in-law, David McCall, whose dad was a local doctor and friend in town. It was Sunday and the clinic was closed, but David's dad said he would gladly meet us there within the next few minutes to try to help out. I probably still owe him some money from fixing my face up like he did. I'll never forget the sound I heard as Dr. McCall cleaned me up to get me ready for stitches. Tink, 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 I heard. I strained my eyes to the side to see what in the heck was making that weird tink noise. I then realized that Dr. McCall was pulling little pieces of gravel out of my face and dropping them into the stainless steel bowl. After we left the clinic that day, I remember Joe and I went to get a big pair of sunglasses. I guess I just thought if they were obnoxious enough, they'd distract people from the gaping hole in my face. I looked like I'd been run over by a tractor or something. And that's how I wound up with this awesome scar. Honestly, back in my 20s, the only thing I would have felt after surviving that crash would have been pride. Sure, unabashed Texas pride. But I felt something completely different as I left the hospital that day. After looking into Joe's tear-filled eyes and staring at my beautiful son in his car seat, I felt stupid. What's wrong with me? I'd made a habit of pushing the envelope pretty much my entire life. Back in high school, when a group of kids would go climb a bridge to jump into some invariably scary-looking body of water beneath, I'd be the kid who climbed just 5 feet higher than everybody else, just because. I was not about to be outdone. Risk-takers in general are sort of hell-bent on tackling the world and climbing to the very top. We don't feel like we're living unless we're walking that edge. There's something about feeling like everything's on the line that makes people feel like they're alive. So for most of my life until that point, I'd felt that if I wasn't redlining it, if I wasn't pushing whatever I was doing to the very max, then maybe I'd lost a step and gone soft like everybody else. Or maybe, God forbid, I was becoming normal. A boring, run-of-the-mill kind of guy who'd been reduced to living out an ordinary life. Normal was the complete opposite of what I'd always wanted to be. But looking at Joe and little Drake after surviving something so dangerous, an entirely new thought flashed through my brain. I am now carrying precious cargo, I thought. The rush of what used to drive me and make me feel alive was being replaced with the joy I now felt as a husband and a father. My wife and my son were a whole lot more important to me than my desire to prove I was man enough to do this or that stupid thing just for fun. Although I wasn't about to stop thrill-seeking altogether, I did realize at the time I needed to grow up. I no longer wanted to purposefully do things that were so outlandish and dangerous that they could throw me instantly into a life-or-death scenario. I no longer had the luxury of driving off a cliff and dying. What I mean by luxury is that growing up, I always imagined I would leave this earth in some dramatic, maybe mixed martial arts sort of way. And I spent a lot of years living off of the rush that recklessness provides. But this big moment made me realize that there's nothing heroic or cool about death by stupidity. And it's a lot harder to take care of a baby and a wife if you wind up in a wheelchair or dead. These days, I still do stuff that the average person might consider a little risky, but they're not the sort of things where something tragic is almost likely to happen. The risks I take now are different. They're more calculated and thought through, but that doesn't mean that they aren't plenty exhilarating. I'm a husband and a father now. As such, I'm way more aware of the impact my choices have on other people. I vowed a lot of things to Joe on our wedding day, and I plan to make good on each one of those promises. I'm still a huge advocate for trusting your instincts and taking leaps of faith when it matters. There are plenty of things worth rushing into the unknown for, but don't be dumb. Save your courage for when it counts. Intermission, a short story on how this book cover came to be. Scarface, a mini Marshall. On top of being an eternal optimist, arguably to a fault, I've always had this sixth sense, or talent, or gift, or whatever you want to call it. I'm keenly aware of my own inner voice. It takes practice to recognize that voice, but once you do, you'll find it to be trustworthy. Unless, of course, it's always telling you terrible things about yourself, in which case, I wouldn't listen to it. What do you think about the photo of me on the cover of this book? You like it? I sure hope so. If you don't, that's okay too. But I knew it was the one the moment I saw it. I want to take a minute to give you the backstory. Whenever Joe and I do a photo shoot, it's a big production. A crazy number of people get together and construct these sets or this scene. Hair and makeup people come out. We get fitted for these beautiful custom clothes. The lighting equipment required is probably worth as much as my truck. So on this particular photo shoot, we were in an ATV on the way to the staged area where we could try to get this perfect shot for the book cover. And my buddy Jeff snapped a candid picture of me. This on-the-fly shot, which took zero planning and zero forethought, spoke to me the most out of the hundreds and hundreds of photos we reviewed at the end of the day. It felt sincere, unexpected, and most importantly, raw and authentic. I'm not a huge fan of the circus that is required to make something appear real. I just like real things, like real. I'm probably particularly sensitive about such things these days. So Jeff's photo stood out to me like a ray of light. The fact that you could see my scar front and center was just like the cherry on top. I'm a little obsessed with this scar, you see. It's right smack in the middle of my forehead, and it's just the kind of scar that a guy can be proud of. This was important to me because what I learned when I got this scar really grew me up and changed me forever. It just felt right for this book. In this world of Photoshop lives and fake news, I just thought that a real photo, snapped in a real pasture by a real person, was in order. It turned out that this photo and two other random options were the final contenders for this book cover. I posted all three outside my office door and forced everyone who walked by to vote on the one that they liked best. And I mean, I had everyone vote. People I knew, people I didn't, folks on Instagram, people from out of state, and people from in town too. I had the FedEx guy vote. I even had a lady vote who had come into the office by mistake just looking for a dentist. One option was the photo I had used to announce the launch of this book. It was funny, a fun photo of me jumping through a wall, and it got a great response. The second was a really handsome picture of me. In my mind, I looked just like Ryan Reynolds, only with longer, silkier hair. Even I understood the appeal when I first saw it. Then this third one. What can I say? It was gritty, a tiny bit out of focus, and a little confusing. I was in an all-terrain vehicle wearing a designer suit, but with an old dirty hat on backwards. And as far as I was concerned, it was the one. But I didn't want to ignore other people's opinions, so I put all three cover options on my door, walked away, and honestly let the chips fall where they may. Before I knew it, the vote count was 74, 16, and 1. I started doing the math on how many employees were left in the building, and there weren't even enough to make up the difference. So I put together this great sales pitch. And you'd probably assume, since I'm a big, bad business owner, that my employees would concede to my preference without getting smart about it, especially since it's my book. But if you assume that, you'd be wrong. The vast majority of them preferred the first two options. I listened. I really did. But then, bam, I yanked the Magnolia Home by Joanna Gaines trademarked rug right out from underneath everybody's feet and chose that third option. And they never even saw it coming. If they know one thing about me by now, it's that I won't go against my gut, especially for the cover of my Juicy Tell-All book. I wish you would have seen the look on these people's faces when I carried in the cover options and announced the winner. This coup d'etat ended up being a great lesson for my team in going with your gut. Yes, somehow I see myself as the freedom fighter in this scenario. It's very important to take other people's opinions into consideration. It's crucial even. You can't operate in a vacuum. But in the end, it's your life. It's your work. The conclusions you come to ultimately reflect you. and it's crucial that it reflects you honestly. So here's the point. Learn to hear your inner voice and trust it. Get a sense of when it's offering suggestions and when it's stating a mandate. And when it states a mandate, listen to what it's telling you to do. Then act fast and don't waste time second-guessing yourself. Confidence in your intuition takes practice. You need to exercise it. Experiment with it. Try to visualize what you want to happen, because if you can't at least imagine it first, you can forget actually making it happen. Then once you can see it, then it's time to act. The only difference between a painter and an aspiring painter is that willingness to put those inner urges into action. So get to it. Just get started and believe you can, then go from there. Eventually, you'll find that hearing and following your inner voice becomes second nature. Today, I'd ask you, what voice are you going to listen to? Everyone has opinions, and that's good. It's what makes the world go round. But sometimes all the opinions can keep us from doing what only we can do. In the end, only I could have known how this book cover was supposed to feel. I needed every opinion I got, if only to confirm what my inner voice was telling me all along. But once I listened to the opinions that everybody else had to say, the final decision had to be mine. If I ever become literally famous, I hope that kids dress up as me for Halloween, just like they do with Harry Potter. But instead of the lightning bolt scar that he had, they'll have a big wishbone-shaped scar in the middle of their foreheads. Wouldn't that be awesome? And now back to our regularly scheduled programming. Part 2, A Time to Grow. Chapter 6, Fear Less. Life has never been particularly scary to me. Between Joe and me, we've learned a lot of lessons the hard way. Riding out the turbulence, even living through a few nosedives, has allowed us to see that fear isn't a part of how we're willing to live our lives. We've experienced some of what people deem as the worst possible scenarios together, and we've come out on the other side. For as long as we've been married, Joe and I have made a habit of just trying things out and hoping for the best, because we're not afraid to fail. Fear has lost its power on us. This is a really important point to understand. When you aren't trying to avoid failure, fear loses its foothold. The courage to take a chance is half the battle. The other half, viewing failure as a teacher and not an enemy. But not all fear is about failure. What if someone hurts us or takes advantage of us or steals from us? That's always a possibility, but we can't let fear be the deciding factor that holds us back. I have a long history of believing the best about people. I never fear a stranger without good, verifiable evidence, and usually not even after that. If faith in others bites me in the butt, then so be it, and Lord knows it has a few times. I'll give you a couple of examples. In college, my roommate Riley and I used to leave the front door open, unlocked all the time. We didn't live in a great area of town, but it just wasn't our style to give it that much thought. I guess we believed we had more important things to worry ourselves with. We left for Thanksgiving break, and I think each of us thought the other had locked up. We came back from that week out of town to find our apartment completely wiped clean. Everything was gone, right down to the Fruity Pebbles cereal in the pantry. We probably would have been a lot more upset about it had we lost anything of actual value. But honestly, it was just a bunch of junk college kids seemed to acquire. We got some insurance money, and we bought all this cool stuff we wanted. A big TV, a tower full of CDs, a great surround sound system. Our place became a 20-year-old's paradise. Then we left for Christmas break. My roommate thought I locked the door. I thought he had. And you guessed it, they cleaned us out again. All of that brand new stuff, less than a month old, was gone. It's kind of laughable now. You'd think we would have learned our lesson the first time, but apparently not. Because some years after that, my truck was stolen out of my own driveway because I left the keys in the ignition. Maybe that sounds like a one-time thing, but that's not exactly accurate. It's just something I've always done. Not necessarily on purpose, but I guess you could classify it as a bad habit of mine. Now, I'll admit that I haven't really tried to change much, because I've always kind of assumed the odds were really slim that someone would steal my car. But the odds were pretty good that one of my buddies might actually need to borrow it. Joke's on me. Turns out my buddies never needed to borrow my car, but somebody did actually want to steal it. And here's another one that hurts a little more. Back when Joe and I had the original Magnolia Market, which we nicknamed the Little Shop on Bosque, I hired a couple of neighborhood kids who couldn't have been older than, let's say, 15. The area where the retail store was located wasn't exactly the best part of town. So when they came by asking for help, there was no way I was going to say no. I was actually really proud that they wanted to earn some money, so I immediately put them to work. They primarily unpacked boxes, helped clean and pick up around the property, and did a few other odd jobs. This went on for weeks. One day after closing, I went out back to mow the lawn, which ended up taking a good bit of time. I left the boys inside the shop with a punch list of closing duties like sweeping the floors and cleaning the bathrooms. When I came back in to tell them they could call it a day, I was surprised to see they were already gone. Initially, I just kind of thought, wow, good work, boys. Way to get after it. It took me a while to realize that something was off, but I didn't fully understand what had happened until Joe came back the next morning and discovered that the cash drawer was completely empty. After that night, we never saw those boys again. Now here's where believing the best about people comes in. I can judge myself for my unwillingness to lock things up, but who am I to judge the people who actually stole from me? I'm going to leave that part to be worked out between them and their maker. I like to believe that the truck thieves maybe had somewhere they really had to be, or that the apartment robbers were really hard up for my CD collection, maybe some fresh undies. What still gets me, though, is the kids from that little shop on Bosque. Those boys work so hard all the time, and then out of nowhere, they made a boneheaded decision like this? That leads me to think they had an urgent need for that money. I would have gladly given it to them if only they'd had the courage to ask for it. The point is, rather than changing how I operate, I choose to think better of people than sometimes they even think of themselves. Even if I got all up in arms about these things, who am I to jump to conclusions? I don't know their story, so I'm not going to make snap judgments about them. All that to say, I will probably continue doing things the same that I've always done. Some might say I'm irresponsible, being a poor steward of my things, or tempting fate. The reality is, it's just what I've always done. And I refuse to let my life be driven by fear of what others might do, or what might happen to me. Now, I'm not recommending that you all do as I do. I actually married a door-locking, alarm-setting, large-dog-purchasing woman, and these days I feel like I live in Fort Knox. But in my heart, nothing has changed. I want to keep my family safe, and I want to use my resources wisely. But fear is not a part of the equation, not even a little bit. The people I love are the only things I hold precious. And my fretting over our safety or future or even our health won't add a single day to our lives. But it might well diminish the days that we've got. I'm going to get on a bit of a soapbox now, and I hope you'll bear with me. If I ever run for public office one day, there's a good chance my stump speech will be about making it illegal to live in fear. The reason I'm so passionate about this topic is that fear will literally ruin every single facet of your life. It cripples everything. You know the saying, hurt people, hurt people? Well, scared people scare people. And thus, the cycle of fear continues on. Fact, life isn't safe. You could do A, B, and C all perfectly right, and then bam, all of a sudden D shows up, and D wasn't even on the guest list. A lot of people spend their days walking around in fear of failure, pain, or even death. But things like disease or war still find their way past triple-locked doors. No alarm system can keep these things away, and I just don't see the point in putting energy into doing what's impossible in the first place. So like I said, life isn't scary to me. I don't sit around and allow the what-ifs and the worst-case scenarios to control me. There are so many things that can knock us down. So why waste 1 minute worrying about what we can't control? I intentionally choose to think about these things differently. I realized a long time ago that if you open the door to fear, even just a little bit, then it all comes flooding in. Franklin D. Roosevelt said famously, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." And on that, he and I can wholeheartedly agree. My point is this. for the rest of your days, you can live in fear of what could happen. You can walk instead of run. You can drive instead of fly. You can leave the big city and move out to the suburbs, but you simply can't protect yourself from the things beyond your control. I don't want to make this too depressing or anything, but right now, this very minute, there are nuclear weapons being tested and chemical weapons being further developed while a quarter of humanity lives without electricity. There are more than 100 different varieties of cancer with many different causes, but no dependable cure. And that's just cancer. An estimated 68,000 different human diseases are classified by the World Health Organization. There are more than 150 million orphans in the world, and nearly 8 million children die of preventable diseases every year. Things like diarrhea, pneumonia, malaria, because they are too poor to afford treatment. To say that even more explicitly, 29,000 kids under 5 years old die because of poverty every day. If the conspiracy theories have gotten any of this right, the air we breathe and the water we drink are slowly poisoning each of us every day thanks to some epic global assault against the human race. You see where I'm going? If we let every potential threat out there dictate how we feel, there's a decent chance we'll all curl up into the fetal position and never even leave the house. Sometimes too much information is immobilizing. I vote that instead of fretting about all the problems in this world, we all become part of the solution. This happens through our willingness to make small, brave decisions every day. No one was born a hero. It takes a lifetime of courageous choices to get there. So quit dodging hard things. When you make the choice to duck left to avoid something scary, you could miss a beautiful opportunity on the right. To this day, I am still so surprised and very proud that Joe had the huevos rancheros to up and move to New York City during college. She went there to pursue her dream of broadcast journalism. That didn't pan out, but she left New York with the beginnings of an even bigger dream. Joe was a bit homesick in New York, but she felt a sense of peace when she would wander through the little home decor boutiques she would find throughout that beautiful city. Those cozy shops inspired her so much that she began to imagine a way to create something like that for herself. And when we got married, this was one of the very first things I encouraged her to do. And you know what? Joe went for it. It didn't matter that we didn't have any money, or that the timing wasn't just right, or that she had no idea what she was doing. That shop of her dreams was going to become a reality. And all that because of that beautiful risk she'd taken in going to New York City. Of course, we don't always know if the decisions we make are going to be life-altering or not. But I'd argue that every choice we make, big or small, points us down a particular life path. It's like those choose-your-own-adventure books that we all read as kids when we were growing up. One choice leads to another, and the result can be amazing. But if we spend our time focusing on what might go wrong or how we could fail, then we're likely to talk ourselves out of doing anything altogether, without even stopping to consider what the cost of saying no might be. Swaddling ourselves up in our security blankets completely restricts our ability to take courageous, bold steps. I have this short little friend, Becker. He's 6 years old and wise beyond his height. Last night, at an impromptu gathering of friends, he requested that the attendees sit as he explained the rules for the evening. And I quote, "At a dance party, even if you were just a little bit embarrassed, you still have to dance. If this small fry isn't a modern-day prophet, I'm not sure who is. If you don't ask out the girl, or the guy, you risk ending up alone, too scared to pursue a relationship. If the thought of traveling to a foreign country terrifies you and you bow to that, you miss out on experiencing the big, exciting world that's just out there waiting for us to discover it. Say you never apply for or accept a job that feels beyond your capabilities, but instead choose to stay in an easy, safe position that never really requires you to grow, change, or build something that matters. That's not just sad for you, it's sad for the rest of us. Because we need you and what you have to give. The other thing about the presence of fear in the process of decision-making is that it can severely cloud your judgment. Fear, dressed up as wisdom, provides very poor counsel. It lures you into thinking that if you will just trust it, it will afford you some level of control. But guess what? You're never in control. So I'm calling bull on that illusion. It's time for a wake-up call. Maybe a little cold water in the face couldn't hurt. Life isn't safe, remember. But life can be wonderful if you choose adventure rather than fear. I get where these fearful tendencies come from. I really do. Humanity has, by and large, come to the conclusion that the world is getting worse and worse every day, and that people are ultimately bad. No wonder everybody's scared to death. Life feels altogether different when your perception shifts, though. It's amazing how gorgeous the landscape of life looks when we choose to believe that all people have good in them and every situation has potential for a positive outcome. It may be buried or dormant, but I truly believe it's there, most likely waiting for someone to look for it, to help unearth it, to expect it, maybe even to demand it. We're all bumbling through life just trying to figure things out. Is any of us perfect? Not a chance. Are some of us up to no good? For sure. Do we get taken advantage of? Of course. Probably me more than most. But I don't want to ever stop believing in people or taking chances on life just because I'm afraid things might not pan out the way I'd hoped. I'm convinced that seeing the bad in the world and in people isn't difficult or wise or insightful. It's lazy. Finding the good in every scenario typically takes a whole lot more work, but the rewards of peace and joy and hope are so worth the effort. It's possible that the perspective shift that I'm describing here is a little more difficult for you than it is for me. Maybe you have one of those certified phobias. Let's see, there's amicophobia, the fear of being scratched. I get that. Then there's phagophobia, the fear of swallowing. Not sure what the day-to-day looks like for these people. And hypnophobia, the fear of sleep. Can't relate to that one. Just to name a few. Or maybe you've got this involuntary fear stemming from some pain or trauma in your past. You never know when some experience will trigger the flight or fight response in you and leave you shaken. If you are an extreme case like this, there's no need to cold turkey it. Maybe baby steps are what's in order here. You might even need to seek help from a counselor or a physician. But whoever you are, whatever your situation, I believe you can still make the choice to move farther away from fear. How about we all start choosing a little more courage today and see what that looks like for tomorrow? There's a scene in this movie I watched with the kids the other night. We Bought a Zoo. There's this dad, and he gives his son an amazing piece of advice. This is the direct quote. I know because I made Ella get up and pause the movie so I could write it down. Then I played it back a second time, and here I quote, "Sometimes all you need is 20 seconds of insane courage, just literally 20 seconds of just embarrassing bravery, and I promise you," he said, "something great will come of it," end quote. That's it. That's the stuff. Each time you muster up what it takes and go for it, the next go-round becomes that much easier. Real and important change begins with small, courageous acts. It's never too late in your story to take a step away from fear. And the good news is that both optimism and courage are contagious. No hand-washing necessary. Simply catch and spread. Chapter 7, Baby Steps. I remember it like it was yesterday. Sometime near midnight, Joe grabbed my arm and whispered, "I need to tell you something." Back in those days, that sentence was typically followed by, "I'm pregnant." Two simple words that normally had the power to thrill me. But because Joe was already pregnant with number 2, I knew this couldn't be the case. Ella, our second child, would be born here in just a few months, and we were still getting used to the idea of what life would be like with 2 babies. I flipped the bedside lamp on, sat up so Joe could tell me what was going on. "Chip, I think it's time we close down the shop," she said. Her voice, matter of fact. I looked over at her in complete disbelief, expecting tears. But she didn't look too sad, and there was no disappointment that I could read on her face. Still, I knew how hard this must have been for her to actually say it out loud. Now, to give you a little context, the original Magnolia store that we had opened back in 2003 was just starting to hum along. Jo was in her element. She had just developed a unique style that really attracted a lot of locals. She had built up a solid customer base and had finally found a rhythm that was really fun to watch and support. My first instinct was to pat her on the knee and tell her to get some rest, and that we'd talk about this thing in the morning. I honestly thought that she just had a long day and wasn't thinking clearly. Back then, she spent most of her waking hours at the little shop with Drake, then a toddler, at her feet. Drake was still waking up in the middle of the night, and she wasn't getting a whole lot of sleep herself. I knew she was completely exhausted, and I didn't want her to make this big decision while she was basically running on empty. But Joanna didn't want to wait until morning. So my next instinct was to give her some advice. I've always been the type of person who swoops in to save the day, so I felt it was my responsibility to throw out a couple of suggestions just to keep this dream of hers going. Not that Joe ever needed my saving, but I couldn't help myself. I mentioned the idea of maybe hiring a couple of part-time employees, one that could help out in the morning shift and one for the afternoon, so Joe could spend a little more time at home during the day. She looked at me with those determined eyes of hers, and she shook her head. "No, Chip. This time, I feel this in my gut," she said. This shop was not a hobby for Jo. This was her life. Joanna's work ethic is a blend of her father's drive and her mother's persistence. That combination made my wife a workhorse who was just plain fun to watch. She was so passionate about every little detail. As soon as the shop closed at 5, Jo would take up the hunt for something new and unique to add to her inventory. She would run into antique stores and thrift shops just 10 minutes before they'd close to grab broken down pieces of this or broken down pieces of that. She'd bring those things home and we'd pour our hearts into restoring those once Drake was in bed. My wife was a one-woman retail machine and nothing seemed to stop her. Until now. Until this. Joanna is an all-or-nothing kind of woman. This characteristic really made it hard for her to balance the work and the home and make it feel like she was doing either one with excellence. Just doing the bare minimum at the store wasn't going to solve the problem. To be able to give these babies her full attention, she knew she'd have to give one or the other up. And of course, the shop was the only option. By this point, I was wide awake, and I knew Jo wasn't going to just let this go. At that time, the shop provided about half of our household income. A necessary supplement to my work flipping and building houses, for sure. So the idea of shutting it down sounded not only risky, but to some extent downright foolish. But she was clearly serious. So we got out of bed, moved the conversation to the kitchen, and quickly started game planning for our future. It's not typical for Jo to come to me with a potentially life-altering decision already made. She's more likely to start a conversation so we can hammer out the possibilities together. But when she intuitively hears something and senses that it's from God, there's no changing her mind or trying to talk her out of it. I wouldn't even dare try. Even back then, when we'd only been married about 3 years, I understood that when Jo heard God in a way that seemed weightier than usual, her discernment of his voice was usually spot on. Jo and I both have strong instincts and enjoy the process of due diligence. But if we specifically feel like God has initiated something, we do not hesitate. Sitting there at the kitchen table, pen and paper in hand, Jo and I spent the night and well into the wee hours of the morning strategizing how to announce the shop's closing and how to sell through this inventory that she had on hand. We also brainstormed ways to make up for the income loss that we were guaranteed to experience. Jo threw out the idea of reviving something that she had done a couple of times in the past. Hosting one-day sales in our home. Jo would stock up on unique furniture pieces and home decor and literally set up shop in every room of our house. These home sales had been very successful, and every last piece typically disappeared by noon. Jo suggested doing about 4 of these a year, and that really started to seem like a viable, workable option. We eventually headed to bed a couple hours before Drake got up, feeling nervous and expectant for this new season we were about to enter. I wanted to be just as supportive of Jo closing the shop as I had been of her opening it back in 2003. and I really was genuinely happy for. Joanna's dream had been to build Magnolia Market into something she was really proud of, and she had exceeded those expectations. Now, 3 years later, she had a new dream, one she cared about so passionately that she was willing to let go of her beloved retail store. She yearned to be home with these beautiful babies. Sometimes the quiet decisions, the one reached at 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning at the kitchen table, are the ones you look back on with the most fondness. That momentous night with JoJo set off a chain reaction of events that quite literally led us to where we are today. And it all happened because Jo said yes to that feeling in her gut, that quiet voice telling her it was time to dream anew. I had never been more proud of her. She and I both knew she was taking a God-sized risk, but she wasn't afraid. Within 2 months, Joanna had sold all of her inventory, settled the books, and let her vendors know she was closing up that tiny shop. The 2 days that stand out the most to Jo from that little shop were the first day she ever opened, she was a nervous wreck, and the day that she closed the doors for the very last time. No matter how difficult it was to walk away that afternoon, Joanna knew it was the right thing for both of us. She took a deep breath, turned the key, and walked away from that little shop on the corner, filled with nothing but peace about her decision to say goodbye. Throughout the following year, I could really tell that Jo loved being at home, really focusing on our children. It seemed like a weight had been lifted off her shoulders. It was a great year, an amazing year, and I think Jo really subconsciously willed Pinterest into existence that year with her sheer force and creativity. This was the time when she really learned to cook, to clean, to garden. She was scrapbooking, crafting, and doing all the innovative stuff she really loves. I knew the kids loved having her home around the clock, but sometimes I actually considered using my body as a human shield to protect those young lives from their mom's endless creativity and this energy and her capacity to do a million small projects all at once. To give you an idea of what I mean, today, Joanna Stevens Gaines is the co-host of a top national reality TV show on which she personally designs up to 18 custom homes a season. In her off time, she manages every last detail of her retail and design empire while lovingly feeding and clothing and caring for 4 young children. All the while, keeping up with me. And this is the same woman who focused all of that creative talent and energy into staying home with her 2 small children. No wonder she got a bit restless. Both Joanne and I agree that there's not a more noble calling than staying at home with your kids. But this woman just had far too much energy for this to be our entire long-term plan. Our poor children. She plumb wore those youngins out. By year 2, Joanna was jumping in on my building projects just to keep from bedazzling the kids. Then, just like that, Joanna was pregnant again with our 3rd baby, our 2nd boy, Duke. I specifically remember during that pregnancy how much she missed having her own true creative outlet. She started asking that I bring home more and more construction plans, and she would sit at the dining room table during the kids' nap time, and she would work on the design, she would tinker with the layout and the functionality of these spaces. She had a real gift for imagining herself in these people's homes. Not in a creepy way. She would sit and pretend it was her own bathroom, kitchen, or even living room, and that made her see and notice things that I would have never considered. She would come up with these quirky ideas that at the time I honestly thought sounded pretty dumb. What do you mean we're tearing off the drywall and leaving these old planks exposed? Ship what? And you think painting this old mantle and then fastening it to the wall will make it feel like a fireplace? That's not going to feel cozy. It's going to look bad. And then we'll be left with huge holes in the wall. And you're going to install an antique door that leads to the pantry? I think the homeowners are going to hate that. In fact, they loved it because Jo had spent the last few years as the owner of a home decor shop, and because she'd spent countless hours studying her customers' spaces at their request, she had become an expert at finding unique ways to fill these homes with meaning instead of just stuff. She actually knew what she was doing, and people were eating this up. Joanna put herself in the middle of the process and made herself an invaluable member of our construction team, a much-needed addition to our crew of clueless men who had zero background and very little sense about all this interior design stuff. And so Joanna Gaines, designer, was born.